Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we will have a special guest to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is an old friend, an old man, and shares a love of chonky bracelets with Princess Diana. Please welcome to the show, Alex Orman.
What was that? I couldn't hear you, Sonny. Could you speak up?
I love the idea of you wearing chonky bracelets.
Chonky bracelets. No, I think that was your thing, John.
Hey, man, I walk like an Egyptian. So before we begin, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows, so we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/fireandwaterpodcastnetwork. So, Alex, you are new to the show, and every episode where we have a new guest, I like to ask him the same question to open. What is your history with Wonder Woman? How did you discover the character?
Well, I've been listening to your podcast. Awesome so far.
Thank you.
And like many of your fellow podcasters, we're of the same generation. It was pretty much Super Friends.
Same generation. You're like 10 years older than me.
Oh, hush. But yeah, it was basically Super Friends to start out with. And my iteration was Challenge of Super Friends in 77. Now, the Wonder Woman series had come out already.
Yeah.
And that was going on too. And that was also the kind of live action introduction. About a year or so later was when I still wasn't totally collecting comics yet, but I'd get like a couple of issues every year. And I picked up Justice League of America 190, I think it was. Yeah, 190.
Oh.
And it was the two-part Return of Starro the Conqueror.
Nice. With the Brian Bolland cover.
Yeah, the Brian Bolland cover, yeah. And I kind of backtracked and I got a couple of the issues prior, especially one where Wonder Woman got body swapped.
Oh, yeah. And well, they all did. Yeah, but the League of Supervillains.
No, this was the one. That was from in the 170s. In the 80s, it was some magic.
Oh, the statue.
Yeah,
yes.
The statue. Yeah. And then even before that was the big crossover with Justice Society and Darkseid.
Yeah.
Crisis on, what was it? Crisis on Apocalypse or something like that?
Yeah, or.
Yeah, so there
New
wasn't
Genesis.
A lot of characterization. On New Genesis, that's what it was. There wasn't a lot of characterization with Wonder Woman. I mean, she was just a big team player in that sense. And obviously in the one with the magic statue, she wasn't even herself. So it wasn't truly, obviously, until, you know, George Perez's run that I really kind of got to know the character Justice herself. And what a great run.
Now, did you actually make the transition at the time? Like, did you buy the Wonder Woman Perez run off the racks?
Yes. I didn't finish. I think I got like the first three issues. And then I would just casually peruse them afterwards. I was really starting to get choosy in the mid-80s with what I was buying.
Yeah.
Just because I was starting to get my really own allowance, and I really had to pick and choose instead of my parents letting me buy everything.
Yeah, it's funny how when it's your money suddenly,
exactly.
It's like, I like this book, but yeah.
But I mean, I was such a fan of George Perez.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I felt such a loss when he left Teen Titans to do Crisis. I mean, we had Crisis, but that was, 12 issues, and that was it. And I knew that I really needed that fix, so I tried it. Again, you know, you're 16, women, female-centric comics just weren't my taste at the time. I enjoyed them as a teen, but I just wasn't into the mythology, the world building that he did.
Which is interesting, because I've heard that from a number of guests, that they're either a big fan of Perez and Ween leaning into mythology as the core of Wonder Woman. And I mean, the first 13 issues are all about mythology. There's one supervillain in the whole first 13, Cheetah, and even she is tied to another mythology. But there are those who love that, and then there are those who are like, yeah, I kind of wanted more superheroics. Like, I wanted more supervillains. And that's coming. Once the Challenge of the Gods is over, Perez and Ween are going to lean in a bit into that.
I think for me, that was just my flavor at the time. I love it now. I mean, I like the world building and I like the mythology because it's so different from, the normal supervillain, of the week kind of thing.
What's funny is you're a big D&D guy.
Yeah.
And so this run reminds me of like a D&D campaign.
Oh, yeah. And it's emblematic of when George was doing side jobs. Like, there was a Atari video game called Sword Quest.
Yeah.
And he did the comics for that. And you see a lot of this artwork represented in this run.
Yeah, it is really cool. It's so funny because when you think of Perez, what's the first comic that pops into your brain?
Teen Titans for me.
Oh, okay. Is there an issue or a...
He didn't do the interior art, but issue 34 of Teen Titans, or is it 32? It's the cover where Cyborg is standing in front of like a broken door and Sarah's being held hostage.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's literally the kind of iconic, like, first actual issue that I had started when I started saying, I'm going to start collecting.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I still remember I picked up JLA 221 and 222, the Earth 2 crossover the Earth 1 Johnny Thunder, and Black Canary is her own mom.
And they have all the heads on the side, the classic, you know, a cast of who's who.
But it's just, so they're great Perez covers. And the interior, it's Chuck Patton. I love Chuck Patton. So the interior art is wonderful as well. But I still remember, and every once in a while I'll stop and I'll go back and I'll look at those covers and I'm like, these covers are so much better than these comics. They're too good for these comics. Yeah, it just isn't. It isn't.
Yeah, right? that was a common complaint I had as a kid, was that what was being sold on the cover wasn't inside. But you'd forget because they had such great stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's interesting. So I love this book too. And I, like you, and I've said this before, I bought it off the rack and I collected it for a while, but then kind of fell away because I was a dumb boy. And it is fun to go back and read, because this issue in particular is the culmination of the first year of this comic and brings literally almost every plot thread together. Yep. You know, you got to love Len and George. They are not Claremontying this. They are like, hey, if there's a thread, we're going to tie it. So today we're going to be jumping into Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 13, which was released in February of 1988. The issue titled Demon Plague has layouts and plot by George Perez, script by Len Wein, inks and finishes by Bruce Patterson, letters by John Costanza, colors by Carl Gafford, and was edited by the legendary Karen Berger. So as you know, listeners, and Alex, we are going to jump into the issue. We're going to do a deep dive into the story, and this is a story that deserves a deep dive. But before we begin, we start every episode with a segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth, where the guest and I each grab Diana's golden lasso and tell one silly or fun truth about ourselves. So, Alex, you're the guest. Why don't you go first?
All right. I think I've told you this story before, but I was a high school Ghostbuster.
So not surprising.
Yeah, right. So in high school, my friends and I kind of made it known that we were really into the supernatural. We had investigated strange lights out in the foothills where I grew up in Yuma, Arizona. We had investigated the ghost of a matron who they named a junior high school after. Supposedly her picture, the eyes of the picture would follow you and they would see like phantom apparitions of her.
That, what, you sure that wasn't just the vice principal at the school, monitoring the students?
Exactly. Rooney. But what had happened, so people knew that we were into the supernatural. But what had happened was one summer, it wasn't summer. It was in the fall. Me and my friends had gone to a drive-in theater. We saw a double feature of Adventures in Babysitting and Can't Buy Me Love.
Oh, that's a 1-2 punch.
I know, right? And in the middle of Can't Buy Me Love, one of my friends was approached by a girl that we went to school with, and they walked off together. And when they came back, we started to get embroiled in this crazy adventure. Apparently, the girl's friend, who we also knew, had started dating this guy who everyone called Damien. His real name was David.
Yeah, that's not a good sign.
He was the leader of a kind of a gang, a group of kids that sold drugs, but they masqueraded as a satanic cult. Yeah, they were basically like hair metal punk guys.
Yeah.
But the guy went by Damien. It was kind of like a George Perez classic Teen Titans supervillain ad hoc group, because you had Damon was maybe like 5'4", and he was the leader. Then you had a really big kind of like hulking bunk guy. You had a tall, skinny, like weaselly guy. You had another girl in it. I mean, it was a classic group.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and they kind of, they sold drugs up on the hill. But apparently, he told this girl that he was starting to date that they were planning a satanic ritual coming up for October 31st. and that they were going to plan on killing a hobo.
Jeez.
Six weeks before Halloween, they were going to start this ritual.
Yikes.
And so the girl started having horrible nightmares and wanted us to do something about it. So
In lieu of the police, yes. Yuma does have its own police department.
So the girl in question, her aunt, worked at the school as well and also had interactions with this Damien. We spoke with both of them. We went to her house, which is way out in the boonies. It was actually a house that was situated at the end of the runway of the airport. But it was surrounded by all these groves of orange trees. So it was really out, secluded out in the middle of nowhere. And they proceeded to weave this fantastic tale of how they had satanic rituals at this house. And they even pulled away a carpet. We thought it was a carpet, but it was really just a big throw rug that covered the whole floor. And there was like a pentagram. And yeah, we were thinking
that's crazy.
Yeah, we were thinking this is really getting out of hand. Yeah,
are you turning my show to a true crime podcast?
I know, right?
Right now.
So all these coincidences or all these supposed like crimes like that were turning out to be kind of coincidences. But we held a seance and we had all of this electronic equipment to detect like psychic activity and stuff. And it was funny because at one point they were basically doing like a test, like just testing out if this was going to be real or not. And they were basically reading out everyone's name. And when it came to me, I kept saying, okay, my name is Dave. My name is Dave. I kept thinking that in my head. My name is Dave. And they actually started to spell out A, and then the two holding is like, no, wait, hold on a second. And they went again. It's like D, A, V. And I said, stop.
I've contacted the other side.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to bring something back. So the teacher, the aunt of the friend, she said she was going to hold a Halloween party. At the time, we thought that they had excommunicated Damien and his group from the house. They thought it was, you know, too heavy and stuff. But really what had happened was that she was still buying drugs from Damien.
Wow.
And she told them everything that we were doing, that we were investigating them.
Oh, yikes.
So a adjacent friend of ours, Jeremy, you know, thought he didn't want to be involved, but he thought it was all funny. One of my friends who was involved said, wow, I had this crazy dream that they were stalking Jeremy. They were all dressed in cloaks and they killed him. And then oddly enough,
Jesus,
Jeremy was messing around. And we didn't have an enclosed campus. It was all like walkways and breezeways and you know, classrooms, disattached classrooms. He said he saw the group down the hallway, wasn't paying attention and walked into one of the girders holding up the breezeway, roof. And had to go to the hospital.
Oh, my God.
And we were then told, Jeremy had to go to the hospital. And he got attacked. And I'm like, what the heck? This can't be happening. So it was all these crazy coincidences. It ended up that summer of 87, a tropical storm went up through the Sea of Cortez and hit our town. So we were all getting ready to go to this party. And we were told that, one, there was a big storm and that Damien and his group were causing it. And two,
oh my God,
that he was going to be there at the party.
Yeah.
So this was after the summer that Lost Boys came out.
Uh-huh.
So we all dressed up like the Frog Brothers.
What?
We had camo, bandanas. We had backpacks full of wooden stakes and holy water and crosses and stuff. And we went to the party. And it was like the Revenge of the Nerds party before they whipped out the marijuana.
Yeah.
It was this most boring party. And the storm really started raging and the power would flicker out since we were out in the middle of nowhere. And then one of the girls said, I think he's outside now. And we all walked outside. And pretty much at that time, the rain just stopped. There was nobody out there. He never showed up.
Uh-huh.
But after that night, we all went home. And we didn't even talk about it for years afterwards. We just basically ended our demonic, you know, Amityville
investigation
Horror service. Ghostbusters investigation.
Oh my.
Yeah. And until, you know, about a year later or so, then I thought, well, maybe I'll be a parapsychologist, you know, we'll go into college, but it never went to anything.
I don't, I, This is, listeners, this is what happens when you live in Yuma, Arizona, which is Tatooine, but with a third sun, with not enough moisture from moisture farming. That is the most insane story. I mean, have you ever looked Damien up on Facebook or like you're tracked down? I mean, I hope he's like a youth pastor or I don't know, something. Yeah.
Runs a soup kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's insane.
Yeah.
That is totally insane.
It's one of the weirdest fond memories I have of high school.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, wow. It explains a lot. That's crap. You've never told me that story before. That is.
Oh, I've told you the story. I probably didn't go into that much detail.
There's no way you've told me that story. I think I remember the demonic, you know, gang who sold drugs to a teacher, you know, in an orange grove. And yeah, I know.
She was the.
Don't give her information out.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm not going to list her name or anything, but she was the assistant for. Boy, I'm trying to remember what they called it back then, but now it's learning disability.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They named it something different back
then. Yeah, like resource room or, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay, well, as is common on this show, though maybe not to this extreme, I have to follow that up, and that is fascinating. I also am going to grab Diana's magic glass, so mine is not going to be anywhere near as supernatural.
Oh, no, but this is a good one.
This is a good story, and I was surprised that I hadn't told this yet on the show, and so I am grabbing Diana's lasso, and I'm going to share with the listeners that I once filmed a commercial for MTV. So back when I was in college, MTV would set aside 2 or 3 weeks of programming each spring for MTV Spring Break. You remember all of that nonsense. And they would film on location in places like Daytona Beach. But one year, they decided to go out west because they weren't capturing the California kids, the kids from out west. And everybody in the west went to Lake Havasu, Arizona. They all descended on this small town that had this awesome lake. And they decided to go out and film. So my friends and I learned about this. And we were like, oh, we're totally going for spring break to Lake Havasu. So we book a hotel and we head out. And what happened is there was a 2-day window where Arizona schools were out for spring break, but California schools were not.
Right.
So Lake Havasu was crowded for Lake Havasu. I mean, we probably doubled their population, but it wasn't yet what it was going to be in a couple of days with all these folks out for spring break. So we're walking around and we are partaking in alcoholic beverages, and we get to the like MTV's dance party kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a guy from MTV walks up to us and goes, hey, do you want to be on TV? And normally I would have said no. I think my friends would have said no, but we were super, super intoxicated. And I was like, hell yeah, let's get on TV.
Right.
So for those of you who remember Bill Bellamy, he was a VJ, a video jockey at the time. He grabs me and he goes, okay, we're going to film a commercial for 1-800-COLLECT, which was a company where you can make cheap collect calls. This is way before cell phones. And he's like, in MTV, they sponsored MTV Spring Break. So I'm like, cool. So the premise was I was going to call my mom back in Phoenix, tell her that my friends and I got in an accident and that she needed to drive the 3 hours to Lake Havasu to bail us out of jail. So I call my mom, and again, super intoxicated. In fact, Bill Bellamy made me put sunglasses on because my eyes were so bloodshot. So I call my mom, and I tell her that my friend Pat, who was driving, hit the London Bridge, which is the famous bridge in Lake Havasu, and that we were in jail and that she had to come bail us out. And she starts yelling at me and, you know, what are you doing? You guys are so stupid. And Bill Bellamy kind of laughs, and he grabs the phone. And he goes, hey, mom, what's up? This is Bill Bellamy from MTV. Sean was just joking. This is all a skit for 1-800-COLLECT on MTV. You're on TV. And my mom goes, I don't know who the F you are. And she starts yelling at him in English and then in Spanish and then in only Spanish. And she goes off on him to the point where he holds the phone away from his head and finally hands it back to me. And he goes, yeah, you need to take care of this. And I was like, all right.
But mom, I saved 44%.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, mom, this is all a joke. I'll talk to you when I get back. Like, just don't be mad. You know, don't throw my stuff out. And we hang up and we go on. And I am convinced that this thing never aired because my mom was so explicit in her anger towards us. But I got back from Lake Havasu, and a ton of people that I worked with, I worked at a grocery store, were like, oh my God, I saw you on TV. And every single person, this was the exact order of their commentary to me. Oh my God, I saw you on TV. Oh my God, you were so drunk. I was like, yeah. Oh, great. So yeah, so that was my brief brush with fame. A nice little sidebar to that story is my two friends and I, right after we filmed that commercial, we come walking off the stage and we're walking up this like staircase to our car. One of my friends wasn't drinking. We were walking up the staircase to the car and Pauly Shore. Yeah, yes. Comes walking down and we're like, Pauly. And he was like, hey buddies. And he had like seen us on the stage. So he maybe assumed we were somebody. And we totally took all these pictures with Pauly Shore. Yeah,
totally chilling with the weeds.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, as a 90s an experience as you get. So it had Bill Bellamy, Pauly Shore, MTV. The only thing missing was Downtown Julie Brown.
Downtown Julie Brown.
Yeah, that's all that was missing. So, okay, so that's my story. Nowhere near as bizarre or twisty and turny as yours.
Well, yes.
but still.
You know, ironically, because we've talked about this story before, because it's infamous with you and Pat.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we were there. I was there.
Oh, yeah.
We were, but we didn't stay. We just drove through, went to Vegas, did a day in Vegas, and then we went to Rachel, Nevada, where Area 51 is.
Oh, that's well, okay. And again, given your story, that now makes more sense. So, listeners, we're going to cut away from the Lasso of Truth, even though that was freaking awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the issue. So I'm going to provide a brief summary and then we will jump in to talk about a very, very important issue in the first year of this series. So this is part four of Challenge of the Gods, and we find Hippolyta deep in the Hellmouth below Paradise Island, trying to avoid harpies and a cyclops in order to find Diana. What she doesn't know is that Diana is thousands of miles away at a gathering of heroes who have been unjustly forced to participate in the Millennium crossover, as many of us were as readers. Diana doesn't remain long, and she ditches Arisia long before Hal Jordan can do so, because, you know, she ages over 18, and then goes back to join her mom.
Right.
Arisia. Got that plot point. Diana and Hippolyta battle Polyphemus, the Cyclops who tormented Odysseus in the Odyssey, as well as the Minotaur, the Chimera, and Echidna, who's the mother of all monsters, all while trying to save Heracles from this stony torment that Hippolyta discovered in the last issue. Heracles can only be saved when Diana binds her mother, who was long ago a victim of Heracles' sexual assault, to him and using her lasso, allowing them to see each other through sort of new eyes and to process anger and hate and get to forgiveness. The two disappear at the end of this process, but Diana has no time to worry about it as the demons and monsters of the Hellmouth escape out of Hercules. He had been sort of imprisoning them, and this wave of demons makes its way towards the exit, trying to get out into the world. Diana uses the amulet Harmonia gave her way back in issue 2 of the series that she also used in battling Ares, except now that talisman is complete. She blocks the demon plague and then charges it with their power, eventually giving it to Ares, much to her chagrin. The gods tell her not to worry, though, as it balances the power of the gods. More to come on that later.
Now, the great thing about this is the issue ends with Hermes suddenly appearing and issuing a final challenge. It's almost like, hey, wait a second, the princess is in another castle. She has to find and kill the manhunter that killed his son, Pan, and has been impersonating him for thousands of years.
Yeah, so thank you for adding that on. It's a fun ending. I will talk about this. I almost wish it weren't there, because this issue is such a, like, conclusion. This is a perfect arc. If you handed somebody the first 13 issues of this book without that little end, it's a complete story.
Yeah, exactly. And it's your famous, you know, record, you know, scratch.
Yeah.
Like, wait a second, we're not done yet.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's serialized fiction. They always have to end on something to get the reader to come back. But really, if I were reprinting this arc as DC Comics, if I were doing the first year of Wonder Woman, I would do issues 1 through 13, and I would just cut off that little end.
Yeah, because technically, all that does is basically lead you to Millennium number 7.
Yeah, and no one needs to be led to Millennium.
Yeah.
I as part of my disease as a comic book collector, completist, and podcaster, I went back and reread Millennium for this, saying like, okay, well, you know, the banner's on the issues, and let's see how it evolved. And there is literally nothing.
It's an unfortunate, just as a sidebar, it's an unfortunate, because the idea is great.
Yes.
They just, you know, with this recent past, they're not going to stick with the Guardians disappearing forever.
Yeah.
And they just didn't execute on the new Guardians well enough.
Well, and I mean, the Manhunter idea was phenomenal. Like, who is secretly a Manhunter? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so funny because the ad I always think back on is for Millennium is this little square ad, and it says, one of these three is a Manhunter. And it's like Black Canary, Captain Atom, Rocket Red number 10, or number 7, who we've met once. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's going to be Rocket Red number 7, not the character who's been around since the 40s or the one who has his own comic book. So, you know, it was a good theory in theory, and it was fun in theory, and the crossovers could be fun, but man, it was a stinker of an event. And, you know, which is too bad because Steve Englehart, you know, legendary writer, Joe Staton, legendary artist, but definitely not their best work. Though we do, and I've mentioned this before, we do get the greatest villain of all time out of it in New Guardians, Snowflame, who's powered by cocaine and then has now been on the Harley Quinn animated show on HBO. So life comes at you fast, man. Okay, so as we jump into the issue, Alex, what are your thoughts on the cover? Why don't you describe it for the listeners and tell us what you think?
So the cover is a close-up of Diana and the Minotaur struggling. It is kind of a departure from the last 13 issues, where there's not much going on in the background. It's just them two struggling. I mean, there's a lot of detail with both the Minotaur and Diana. And you know what's kind of funny? It's almost, when I look at this, I almost see Phil Jimenez.
Yes, more than in the face.
Grimace. Yeah, he does a much more elongated face. And this Diana has an elongated face. And again, it's the least eye-catching of the last 13. But it's still classic Perez. It's still better than a lot of covers I've seen.
No, it is definitely Perez. So it has a certain standard. It is, I 100% agree with you. If I'm ranking the first 13 covers, this comes in last place. And I love that you picked up on the Jimenez piece because I was trying to figure out, because this is before Jimenez. Jimenez hasn't hit yet.
Right.
You know, the Minotaur is grimacing. Diana's grimacing. And it really does. I love Phil Jimenez, so what I'm about to say is not in any way disparaging him. He's one of the best artists in the history of the comic book medium. But every once in a while, early in his career, before he learned to soften a little bit, his characters' faces look like they ate too much cheese. Like there was like a constipation face. It's like Gary Frank.
Unworldly. I mean, almost Cthulhu-esque.
Yeah, there was like a harshness to it. It was almost like Gary Frank Deadeye early in his career.
Yeah.
And Jimenez, you know, eventually works through that and again is an amazing artist, but it has that feeling to it. And then I cannot get over, and I need to, but I can't. The Minotaur is like snorting out at Diana because he's fighting so hard. But the like gusts from his snort are palpable and are like pushing against her. And I'm like, oh, that's a detail that we could have left out, George.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, that's not
working. And the drooling too.
Yeah, it just isn't. It's not a great cover. And then you've got, you know, the messiness of the Wonder Woman logo, the Millennium Banner. Mm-hmm. You know, we even have some text that this is Challenge of the Gods Part 4. So, not an auspicious beginning, though deceptively a very important issue. So when we open the issue, Hippolyta is standing by Hercules, who has been encased in stone, and the harpies are picking at him. And she's thinking about, gosh, he's wailing in torment. Normally I would stay and save him, but I've got to find my daughter. And instead she stumbles upon a Cyclops, really the Cyclops, Polyphemus, who was very famously blinded by Odysseus in the Odyssey. If you remember when Odysseus invades his cavern, Polyphemus asks Odysseus, what's your name? And Odysseus tells him nothing or nobody. So that way later on, when Polyphemus is reporting the event to the Cyclops police, he can say, nobody attacked me. And they're like, okay. It's like, well, that's okay. That's interesting. So this is a really funny little crossover between, and especially because they're remaking the Odyssey coming up with, I think it's, who's going to be in it? It's
Tom Holland in it and Zendaya.
Tom Holland. It's the guy who slept with Jimmy Kimmel. And Sarah Silverman.
Matt Damon.
Sorry. It's so sad that that's what I need to do. Matt Damon's a wonderful actor. And I'm like, the guy who slept with Jimmy Kimmel and Sarah Silverman. Yeah. So they're remaking the Odyssey. So this is nicely timed. So she's trying to sneak by Polyphemus. And in doing so, she stumbles across a skull that looks like the skull of Pan. So the, you know, deception of Pan is getting more and more uncovered. The gods see this. And Hermes races to get Diana to bring her to Hippolyta, in part because he wants to find out the mystery of who killed his son. So What are your thoughts on, what are your thoughts on the amount of page space Hippolyta gets in this arc?
I mean, this is definitely not just Diana's challenge, but this is Hippolyta's challenge as well. We'll probably go into this a lot later, but she is, you know, still an overprotective mom.
Yeah.
And she wants to make sure she's there Diana has a preordained, you know, path, and it's laden with pain.
Mm-hmm.
And she's doing her best to basically reduce that as much as possible. It's interesting, like the first couple of panels with Heracles ensconced in, stone or whatever.
Yeah.
When I first see this, it definitely reminds me of when Trigon was transforming New York
in Teen Titans,
the Baxter series. Everyone had these like pained expressions with the overstretched jaws.
Yeah.
I remember even Superman was similarly like that. George Perez, he knows a pained face.
Yeah.
He's the master of the ugly cry.
Yep.
And just, I am in so much pain, I cannot stand it.
Well, and actually that's a super great callback, because it looks like those flesh bridges of people that Trigon builds when he takes over New York. So and then mythologically, it's a callback to Prometheus.
Yes.
So Prometheus is a Titan.
Mm-hmm.
He supports the Olympians in the war against the Titans. So when the Olympians take over, Prometheus has an elevated place. But at one point, he steals fire from the gods and he takes it to humans, which ignites humanity, basically ignites civilization. It's funny. When I used to teach classical mythology to high schoolers, we used to have this debate about whether Prometheus should or shouldn't have been punished for this.
Right.
And I had a group of kids one year, brilliantly, in condemning Prometheus and defending Zeus. They said, yes, he steals fire, but fire is the start of technology. And the end of technology is the atomic bomb, which could destroy our entire planet.
Right.
So that's why Zeus didn't want humans to have it. And I was like, oh my God, like that was brilliant. Like
that is brilliant. Yeah, that is really good.
Really smart kids.
And paralleling Prometheus is when, Prometheus the vulture.
Yep.
Or no, it was the eagle.
Yeah.
The eagle that plucked
liver.
Yeah. And now they've got all these harpies around Hercules' head.
It really is cool. I mean, Perez and Ween are leaning into the mythology.
Absolutely. Realm, and I'm loving it as an adult.
Well, I've talked about this on the show before, and you're a much bigger D&D guy than I am. Did you read the Gods and Monsters or the handbook for D&D for Greek mythology? I forget what it's called.
Yeah, Deities and Demigods.
I loved that. I read that, the pages off of that. I actually, weirdly, my elementary school library had it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't that cool? I mean, it was Oregon, so, we had one computer where you could play Oregon Trail, and we had D&D handbooks, so kind of explains a lot about...
And the librarian dressed up as a frog?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So Hippolyta is fighting, she's trying to sneak by Polyphemus. He wakes up because he's starving, and he smells her, and she's, smells food.
Yeah, I smell food!
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I like to think that's his accent. Saw him in Grenadine Pants.
Yeah,
exactly it. Same voice actor. And so he grabs Hippolyta, and this is right when Hermes has swept Diana back, so she helps her mom. Polyphemus is going mad, and Diana binds him to a column while they consider their next step. And their next step really has to do with going to see what's going on with Heracles, because Diana realizes one of the challenges she was given is to bring Zeus back his most prized possession, or the thing he wants the most. And she puts together, oh, that might be a person. It might be his son, Heracles. So they're kind of walking back towards this pained Heracles in stone. And that's when they're attacked by the Chimera Echidna and the Minotaur. I have some real problems with the Minotaur attacking them, because the first time I encountered, I had this issue off the rack, so I guess not the first time, but the first time that it sunk in with me that I encountered the Minotaur in a Wonder Woman comic is Ferdinand in the Greg Rucka run with Nicholas Scott.
Right.
In 189 of this volume, or somewhere close to 200, when Rucka comes in and he takes the book over, and she's like a diplomat at the UN, and he gives her this. I mean, it's a whole refresh of the book. It's one of the great runs of the book. And Ferdinand is her chef, and he's a Minotaur. I don't know if he's the Minotaur, but I love Ferdinand. And then even in Kelly Thompson's Absolute Wonder Woman, Minotaur was introduced recently and is a friendly figure that helps Diana. So I don't know. I definitely had a little bit of a twinge.
Well, historically, the Minotaur is a hostile creature.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's interesting because you have Echidna, you have the Chimera, which is a direct child, but the Minotaur is not.
No.
The Minotaur, and so they could have used there's so many other,
there are other monsters they could have used.
There's Larna, there's the Caucasian eagle.
Yeah.
yeah, it's so funny. There's the mother of Medusa, Gorgon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They could have done that. There's a couple of dragons that she produced. But the Minotaur just seems like, I've gone 13 issues and I haven't done a Minotaur yet.
Yeah.
I need to put that. They did kind of like a deities and demigods throughout these issues. This was like the last gasp. Like, we're rolling. We gotta put a dragon in. We gotta put the glittering, slime. We gotta put all the monsters.
Lion in the Briefs Fire.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's part of the overarching theme of this issue of the demon plague and what it is. The Minotaur fits because it is a monster and it is a famous monster. But you're right. The others are sort of directly godly descendants, where the Minotaur is the offspring of the wife of Crete and a bull.
Oddly enough, I mean, he's the more interesting of the characters.
Oh, yeah.
The Chimera just kind of wanders off eventually and then just starts attacking the Harpies.
Yeah, this is the funny part about that. There is a weird plot hole where they are fighting this pitched battle against the Minotaur and the Echidna and the Chimera. And the Chimera is badass.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lion and it's got wings and it's breathing fire. And then Polyphemus comes running back and he's like, food, food. And he picks up the Minotaur. And he's like, whoa, the last thing I picked up that was hairy and had horns gave me indigestion.
Right.
But, oh, well, I'm going to eat this guy anyway. And then you're like, oh, okay, now they're going to turn to finish Echidna and Hippolyta decapitates Echidna.
Yeah, great scene.
And you're like, okay, here comes a big fight with the Chimera. But literally the Chimera, like, wanders off. Like, just as like, oh, hey, squirrels.
Yeah,
and he's like,
exactly.
I'm going to attack these harpies for no reason.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait, what? They definitely don't explain that at all.
I think at that point, Ween and Perez were just like, let's just wrap it up.
Yeah, they're like,
we got to go.
We got to get to
it.
But okay, so speaking of Polyphemus grabbing the Minotaur, eating him, and talking about godly indigestion, it does bring me to my first secret question of the episode. And I am really proud of this because it's so dumb.
Yes.
So in the story, Polyphemus is fed Pan's dead body, which gives him eternal indigestion.
Yep.
However, when he gets a chance to eat another furry godly creature, the Minotaur, he jumps at it, even though he knows it will make him sick. What is a meal or restaurant at which you eat that always makes you sick, or often makes you sick, but you continue to go back?
Okay, so you are familiar with this because we've done it several times. But it's YC's Mongolian Barbecue.
Oh, I love YC's.
I don't know what it is about the combination of which oil it is, which protein, maybe it's just the size, but I guarantee you about at least an hour after I finish my bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's probably like the size of a human head. About an hour later, I'm like, let's go. I got to go to the bathroom right now. And it's like, It's like the energy torrent we see later in this.
The demon plague.
Yeah, the demon plague.
So for those of you who may not know what Mongolian barbecue is, there's this long buffet line. You're given a bowl at the beginning, and you walk by and you pick like raw meats, and you pick vegetables and noodles, and then all these different oils and sauces, and then they stir fry them together into a bowl. And it is delicious, but it is absolutely a recipe for like you're not you don't take a date to YC's Mongolian barbecue.
No, that's colonoscopy prep.
Yeah. Really, the demon plague is a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a great, and actually I'm super now hungry for YC's. That is a great example. My example is similar. For those of you who remember Fuddruckers, that chain. So it was almost trying to be like a 50s burger chain.
Mm-hmm.
They had, you'd go in and they handmade burgers.
Steak burgers.
Steak burgers.
So
it was a sit down restaurant. It was like elevated fast food. You would sit down, they'd make the burger. They had like a whole buffet thing of condiments. And then they had,
I think I know what you're talking about.
Oh, you know where I'm going. The best thing in the world. They had chili cheese fries.
Yes.
They were the best. They were the thick steak cut fries. Mm-hmm. They had good chili. They put cheese on them. They were like ooey, gooey goodness. But oh my God, I would eat those. And literally, I would be eating them and enjoying them and eating and enjoying them. And then at one point, I would stop and my stomach would go, why?
Yeah.
And
yes.
It would make an announcement. It would make a proclamation to the room that I had sinned yet again.
I think it was the combination of the cow's milk and the cheese.
Yeah.
that was raised on an Indian burial ground. And cayenne
which you
pepper,
investigated.
Yes, exactly. And the cayenne pepper in the chili was probably from some voodoo loa.
Oh, my God. Those, and they were so good.
Yeah, so good.
They, every time, I mean, literally every time I would eat them, within an hour, I'd be like, why? Why did I do it again? Why?
I'd hear a 3, 2, 1, lift off, and then I'd shoot from the toilet.
So, listeners, you guys are all really great about writing in at fireandwaterpodcast.com with your feedback, and so many of you respond to secret questions. I would love to hear, especially regional ones, especially people who aren't, because Alex and I are both in Arizona. And Fuddruckers was a national chain.
Yes, it was.
And
because I ate in Washington D.C.
Yeah, and Mongolian Barbecue is national. If that chain,
yeah, it's a different name. Yeah,
but I would love to hear what else. You just can't quit. You can't quit. I couldn't. Yeah. And Fuddruckers, they've all closed now. There was one left about 20 minutes from here, or for where I live. There's one about 20 minutes left in a very bad neighborhood. And one day I was off from work, and no one else was home, and I'm like, I'm going to go to Fuddruckers, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to race back, and because I know how it's going to impact me. And I got there, and the windows were shuttered and everything, and I still tried the door. Even though the windows were shuttered. Yes. And, you know, there were like
– bullet hole in the
door. Oh, my God. It was clearly war-torn, and I still was like, but chili cheese fries, man. So we get this fight with a kid – or again, Polyphemus grabs the Minotaur. They chuck off a cliff. They're done. Hippolyta decapitates Echidna, and now it's time to try to save Heracles. And I'm curious what you think about this moment. The brutal assault of Hippolyta and the Amazons by Heracles and his men in issue one is pretty unflinching. Now, mythologically, he has been cursed by Medusa with madness.
Yes.
But still, from a modern perspective, it is a super troubling scene. And so, this idea that Diana has, it's all about Hippolyta's nobility, right? Here is a man that did something so horrible to her, the most horrible thing that's ever happened to her.
Defined Hippolyta.
Yeah. And she has spent centuries processing this trauma and moving past it. She's an amazing leader and queen and mother. But now she's confronted with this man over whom she now has power. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a credit to Hippolyta and the Amazons that instead of taking advantage of that power, or rightfully, justly condemning him and just walking away.
Yeah.
So all she has to do is walk away. She and Diana try to save him, and Diana binds Hippolyta to Heracles as he's trapped in stone with their lasso. And it's ethereal in how Paris and Ween describe it, but they almost mind meld and they kind of see the world from each other's eyes. And then
they both release.
Yes.
Again, another ugly cry scene.
Yeah.
You know, great with the mouth agape. Yeah, this is the challenge. This is the last challenge, is letting go of your pain.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because this entire arc has been about tying threads from the first issue and beyond, but especially the first issue. And the greatest sort of assault, you know, that Heracles and his men, that assault on Themyscira or on the Amazons, has been this generational wound, this generational trauma that has defined the Amazons, not seeking men, mm-hmm. Diana going to man's world and then being very worried about what could happen to her.
I mean, even before that, with the opening scene of the caveman killing his wife.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's about, you know, how the evils of men, you know, can really traumatize women and how they can get past that.
Well, and the great thing is, and this is for 1987 or 88, for Perez and Ween to not give the agency to the male character.
Yes.
The agency is all Hippolyta's. It's all Hippolyta's decision to forgive. It's all Hippolyta's decision to not define her life by it, to move on. And then also to be a noble enough person and to espouse the nobility of the Amazons to actually save her own attacker. So, I mean, it is a profoundly moving moment. But I'm not going to lie, man. I wrestle with it. Like I'm like, oof, like this is, that first issue is brutal and it makes it all the more noble that she does this. But part of me is like, I kind of wish she had punched the statue and crumbled it to, you know, like I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, I've read that George Perez did a lot of research after he said, I'll take this job.
Yeah.
And that he read a lot of William Moulton.
Oh, Marston.
Marston, yeah.
His writings.
Yeah, so. And stuff that he wrote before and after he did Wonder Woman. And that he there was a lot of homage to the way he wanted women portrayed.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, part of his origin for Wonder Woman, you know, was during the, you know, war was building in Europe. And he thought, you know, we've already done this before. It hasn't worked. I think the savior of humanity might actually be women. And he even talked about advocating, let's let women run the world.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an avatar for, you know, for Wonder Woman.
Well, and that idea of like loving submission, submitting to love, submitting to a higher power or a higher nobility and authority. Yeah, definitely. That's a great point. This is very Marston-esque. Mm-hmm. We get a flat-out rejection of war here. And instead, just like the first arc of the book, the Ares conflict results in her not fighting Ares, but instead showing him, hey, if your plan goes through, here's what happens to the universe. You're left alone. And he weeps and he stops his plan. Like only Diana could have stopped him.
Right.
And then only Hippolyta could have helped. And I didn't want to use the word redeem. That's probably too strong a word, but like could bring Heracles' story to continue.
Right.
You know, wherever it may continue. And so it is a powerful moment. And again, it's what separates Diana and her mom and the Amazons from other heroes. But right as Heracles is freed, all the demon plague was kind of inside him. Some had leaked out, and it is a Perezian, I don't even know how to describe it, like a Perezian swoosh of energy.
Yeah, well, you've seen it before in Crisis.
Yes.
The times where the shadow demons have appeared and they're swarming the earth.
Yeah.
Or where the not Society of Magic, the League of Magicians are pulling the shadow's demon. He's a master of this like sort of like energy tube of beings and stuff.
Yeah, this swirl of energy creatures. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen it in Crisis. We've seen it in the Titans. We've seen it, you know, we've seen Supergirl die from it. Seen Wonder Woman get blasted to clay by it. And she flies to the opening of the Hellmouth. Mm-hmm. And she's got Harmonia's talisman, but it's whole now.
Yeah.
And she holds it up against the demon plague. And it's a great image. Yes. I mean, It is such a great image. And I want to point something out because it's I'll talk about this later because it's my favorite image in the book. But Perez is not only a master at tying threads up in a book, he's also a master at doing it artistically, like of doing art, referential panels that not only refer back to a previous story so that some of its emotional weight comes through, but that also can tie the loop. And the last time Diana was blasted like this by Ares and went down to the ground, and we talked in that episode about it looked like the blast from the Anti-Monitor, Crisis 12.
Devolved her.
Yeah. It devolves her, takes Wonder Woman Volume 1 off the shelves, takes that Wonder Woman out of continuity. And it also looks like the Supergirl blast that kills Kara.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think it's accidental. I think this is Perez channeling this style he has and these blasts he's used that have taken prominent female characters off the board. But this time, this iteration of Diana blocks it.
Well, he is on record. I've read that he said he did not like the way that they did Wonder Woman.
You can tell in the issue. Yeah. It is given like almost lip service. Mm-hmm. It effectively almost happens off screen. So she blocks the demon plague. And the Hellmouth is starting to collapse, and she's able to absorb all of these demons into Harmonia's
amulet,
her talisman. And she's able to save the day, and then she's whisked off very suddenly to the Aerophagus where Ares lives. And he's like, give me the talisman. You know, he's like, it's very...
She resists. She's like, I cannot, but I must.
And this is a place where... the storytelling now, again, Perez and Ween have earned our trust. And anytime they're going to leave a plot hole open like this, we know they're going to close it. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with it. But she spent the first six issues like defining herself by fighting him from gaining power. And now all of a sudden almost dies to stop this demon plague. And then is like, okay, I feel it's right. The gods are telling me it's right. Yeah. Here you go.
And he responds with, now I have the ultimate power of destruction in my, you know, and disappears.
He doesn't exactly make you feel better about it. He doesn't go like, thank you. This restores the balance of the universe. All is well now. He's like, ah, ha, ha. I'm going to, oh God, he's going to go destroy everything.
All of a sudden a voice goes like, choose the form of the destructor.
it is definitely an interesting moment. And then the gods appear to Diana because she's like, oh, man, did I do the wrong thing? And they're like, no, 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 sister, you did the right thing.
Yes.
You restored the balance of the universe, the balance of power.
Only the greatest of warriors could have done
right.
that.
Right. Only the most loving and true of warriors. Mm-hmm. So we have that moment. And then, again, we end on that cliffhanger where Hermes says, you're not done yet. I want you to go kill the guy who killed my son. But let's back up a little bit. So,
and I want to I do want to back up because I want to ask my first secret question.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Bring it.
So it took a tremendous amount of emotional strength and will for Hippolyta to forgive Hercules and to forgive herself in a sense and allow the spell to be broken. You know, given that all that trauma that he put on her, it literally did define her as a queen, as a leader, as a mother. With you in that same scenario, do you think that you would have that ability? Have you ever been put in that kind of situation where you kind of had to forgive someone with that much trauma that had been put upon you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to modify the question a little bit because I don't want to compare trauma. And I've never experienced the specific trauma she experiences, so I don't want to compare anything that I've gone through to her. But like as a question, like have I ever had to forgive somebody who inflicted trauma? Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a loaded, great secret question. Not as deep as my "What place do you eat at that gives you diarrhea?" question. But
And do you think you have it now as opposed to previous instances?
So. I've talked about this a little bit on air, you know, because we've been friends for so long.
Sure.
We had a very tumultuous relationship with my father.
Oh, yeah.
He was a charming man who had punctuated moments of kindness, but is overwhelmingly not a very good human. And really, his, you know, substance abuse and violence and abuse defined my childhood, my sister's childhood, my mom's marriage to him. And then even long after they were separated, it was still kind of there haunting. And as I got older, realized that like I had defined my life by him. I had defined my life by, and when I say older, I mean like teen, college. Right. You know, I started working. My dad was often unemployed because he was an alcoholic. And I started working at like 13 or 14. I lied and got my first job so I could, you know, could work and get money. And I was hyper vigilant about school, especially when I got to college. Like I put myself through school. I was going to graduate from college because no one else in my family ever had. I was going to prove that I was worth something. And I think it was in a way, and this is probably unfair to my sisters, but I think the weight of my father's violence and trauma weighed heavier on me as the only boy than it did on them. Or not heavier, but weighed differently. Because like my mom in sort of less kind moments would yell at me and be like, oh, you're just like your father and things, you know, really. Yeah. And so even though I was, you know, the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because I started dating somebody when I was in like a freshman or sophomore in college. And she was a really good person, very stable, from a very stable family. And I kind of got to see her family and what a good family dynamic should look like.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh, I'm tired of letting this define me. And so I lived in Phoenix. My father lived in Tucson. I drove down to Tucson and had like a real, like, you know, goodwill hunting, you know, kind of session where we, you know, we talked and I just said everything I had to say. And, you know, to his credit, he kind of sat there and took it and, you know, he kind of pushed back at times, but for the most part was like, yeah, you're right. I was a terrible person. I was a terrible father. And I allowed myself to forgive, not forget, but forgive in that moment. And then where that culminates is, he had missed my high school graduation, because he was drunk. And I told him, I'm never inviting you to any sort of pillar of my life again. Like you're not allowed ever again. And then we had this big talk. And then like a year and a half later, I was going to graduate from college and I invited him to the graduation. And I said to him, if you miss this, you are not allowed. You can never call me again. We're done. You're not my father. We're done. And to his credit, he came. And then I even let him come to my wedding, you know, which was pretty big.
Right.
And so, you know, I never forgot. And forgive is a hard word because when you have that kind of like childhood trauma, it loves to show up in new ways at each new part of your life. So like when I became a dad, it showed up in a fun new way, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I have had to. And I am proud of that, actually. I think a lesser man would have never forgiven him. And I'm proud of myself for forgiving him and even trying to like sift through the dirt to find the little gold nuggets in my memory of him because he's been dead for so long. Yeah, that was a good question. Could I do it now? I don't know, man. I think about all the time? You know that movie Inside Out, that Pixar movie? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know how the emotions yes. drive the little girl's head, and joy is the predominant emotion for yep. her? And then they go to the mom, and her predominant driver is sadness, and they go to the dad, and his is anger?
Yeah.
I think about that all the time. Because I'm like, man, there is something about being a man, yep. and as you get older, I don't know, you're just more curmudgeonly.
Yep.
So I'd like to think I could, but I don't know if I would. What about you?
That's a great question. I am the lesser man. So I'm honestly better at forgetting than forgiving. I've seen, you know, as we're getting older and more curmudgeonly, yeah. that I am sometimes reacting to a little too personally, in the sense that I see somebody get abducted by ICE in a video to somebody who just picks up like a package of chicken at the grocery store and then just leaves it, you know, somewhere outside, yeah. you know, like on the
all injustices
yeah,
or rain.
All, yeah. yeah, exactly. I'm getting that same kind of like aggravation. And so I can have a friend or a coworker slight me. Mm-hmm. I mean, and possibly not just like a little slight, but like really offend me. And maybe a little time goes by and I've completely forgotten about it. But I know that there's something in the back that I haven't forgiven him
yeah.
or her for. And so if it happens again, then I start, you know, like hitting myself saying, why didn't I learn from that? Why did I, yeah. you know, why haven't I confronted them? That kind of thing. So, yeah. And for me, I guess part of my coping is that I easily forget the, you know, agencies that come up against me.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a healthy level of that, right? Where like you can't keep everything or every, not, you know, yeah. can't take everything personally,
yeah.
What you're describing, you're right, is not necessarily a healthy level, because you're not then on guard for something again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's interesting. It's a great question. I think it is one of the reasons I love this book. Yeah. And one of the reasons I was, when I joined the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it was starting my show. One of the reasons I was drawn to this run of this book was because emotionally things are so chaotic in the world.
Yeah.
That I wanted like a little harbor of yeah. like, hey, love wins the day mm-hmm. and forgiveness wins the day and the power of, you know, to go all Huey Lewis, but like the power of love and yep. the power of forgiveness and like a hero that just takes a different path mm-hmm. while still having fun four color adventures. And so that's a great question. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that Hippolyta could see the larger picture.
Yeah.
In that the forgiveness would save the world, basically.
Well, her daughter, too. Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And she would do anything for mm-hmm. her daughter, which, again, I mean, I love Hippolyta. It's so funny. John Byrne is one of the, you know, he's on the Mount Rushmore
yep.
of comic book creators. But he takes some well-deserved flack for things that he's done in the mm-hmm. past. Like, he didn't need to destroy the Vision. And, you know, there's a bunch of stuff, you know.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff he's done as a comic creator. And I'm not even going to talk about stuff he said online. But as a comic book creator, you know, sometimes he'll go in and be like, I'm going to retro-boot everything to what I like. And but again, way more great than bad. But one of the things he does during his run, you know, in the 100s, it's like 100 to 137, mm-hmm. when he takes over Wonder Woman, is he laments the absence of a Wonder Woman in the Justice Society, because, you know,
yes.
she was their secretary, which mm-hmm. is sexist. But he has Hippolyta mm-hmm. go back in time and be the Wonder Woman of World War II, Polly.
And there's some great stories with her.
I love that. Yeah. I think it's so awesome. I think she is a hero in her own right. It's great that she was with the JSA. It's great that she has that connection.
Yeah.
And they've actually recently reinstated that
yes.
into continuity. So
I'm so glad some of the really great ideas that came out of the early 2000s are coming back again, which technically were spawning from, you know, pre-crisis. Yeah.
No, it is. I'm glad to see Hippolyta as much a character in this book as Diana. And
yeah.
So what we learn as we look at the book and we look at the challenge of the gods as a whole is, if you remember when Zeus issued this challenge, the gods said to Diana, this isn't just a challenge for you to accomplish, to finish and win the day for mm-hmm. the gods. You're going to learn your history,
yes.
and she does, meeting Diana Trevor.
Yeah.
And you're going to find your special purpose.
That was such a great issue last issue.
Yeah. Well, and I chuckled. The only way I know how to put it is find your special purpose, but, you know, you've seen The Jerk.
Yeah.
Very different special purpose. But anyway, you're going to find your fate, your destiny, like mm-hmm. why it was you exist. Now, the thing that's fascinating is they do not brightline it in this issue. They explain it, and there's a lot of inference. but they don't brightline it yet. And so what you have to infer from the Challenge of the Gods, and I read along with the show, so there may be more of an explanation coming in the epilogue in the next issue. But effectively, the first woman created from clay is Pandora. And Zeus creates her as punishment to man. I mean, there's a lot of misogyny in the Greek myths. Because Prometheus stole fire from the gods and gave it to man, Zeus wants to punish man, so he creates the first woman, Pandora. And he actually gives her to Prometheus's brother, Epimetheus.
Right.
And it's funny, because Prometheus means forethought, and Epimetheus means afterthought. So, you know, she's kind of set up from day one.
Right.
And he gives her the box, and it's you know, the Adam and Eve story. It's all creation myths that unfortunately blame women. And he says to her, look at this big shiny box that's going to talk to you when you're asleep and tempt you. Whatever you do, don't open it. So, of course, she can't resist, and nor is she supposed to, right? Fate's not going to let her.
Right.
She opens it, and the demon plague, all the evils of mankind.
Yep.
And this is what's interesting, is it's all the evils of mankind, meaning like, you know, sloth, gluttony, violence, wrath, all that. But also the potential for monsters like the Chimera, the Minotaur, all of those things come whooshing out. The part people always forget is at the bottom of the box is hope. So she also brings, you know, that hope into the world, which is important. But Pandora, and I hate even using this term because it's a sexist view of her, but it makes sense the Greek gods would have this. Her sin of releasing the demon plague is redeemed by the next woman created by clay and infused with powers of the gods. And in this case, instead of a creation of a Pandora as a curse to man, Diana is the blessing to man, showing that the gods have grown and learned. And Diana redeems Pandora's greatest quote unquote sin by taking the demon plague she released, putting it, you know, getting it back under control, but then giving it to Ares? giving it to Ares? So that is a massive, massive revelation. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you're totally spot on. We've seen it in other mythologies where you have this, like, woman with the original sin.
Uh-huh.
You don't often have a parallel story having a woman redeem them.
Yes.
With the challenges and the whole, like, the first 12 issues or whatever, it's just a great kind of introduction to this reimagined Wonder Woman and the mythology behind it, but all the Greeks, the Themiscarans, all that kind of stuff. I felt like they overused Hermes quite a bit, but he is the messenger.
Yeah.
And then this whole thing with using Pan, you know, knowingly, having Pan being his son, you know, as a manhunter for thousands of years, that's a little crazy.
The millennium of it all could be removed pretty readily.
Exactly. But this kind of story of redemption and knowing, like, this is her purpose.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good ending to the story and a good use of a combination of myths.
You bring up something really interesting because the parallel to this in Christianity would be a female Christ. Because you have Eve get blamed for the apple in Eden. Very similar to Pandora, right? Here's this bright, shiny tree.
Yep.
Don't touch it, but I'm not going to really give you the ability not to touch it. You know, you're going to touch it. And then we're going to blame everything on you and your gender. Had you know, the Christ figure in Christianity been a woman, then it would have been that same parallel of, like,
and isn't there also a kind of apocryphal myth of Lilith, the woman before Eve, technically?
When, and in Judaism, you do see, you know, the Shekianu, the female force of God, as sort of this redeeming force of love. And so, yeah, it really is freaking high-level writing. Like, this is Alan Moore-level storytelling. But they don't – the one place where I think the issue fails a little bit is they don't draw enough attention to it. Like, you have to read this really closely, and you have to read it almost start to finish, kind of issue 1 to issue 13. Mm-hmm. Now, that's brilliant, and I love that they trust their readers enough to do that. I do wish they had drawn a little bit more attention to it, because I did not pick up on any of this when I was younger.
No.
It wasn't until I was rereading it for the show that I was like, oh, holy crap. Her fate is the redemption of Pandora.
Right.
And the redemption of women, and she's a gift from the gods. That's amazing. Like, that's phenomenal. Like, yeah, I wish there would have been a little bit more focus on it.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I picked up later, rereading it again, was honestly from other people, like posting or doing reviews as such. And I'm suddenly realizing, oh my gosh, yeah, he wasn't that concrete with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, it's so good. It's so well written, and it's such brilliant storytelling. But I just wish he had lampshaded it a little bit more. And it brings up a secret question for me. So Diana, in this issue, in the Challenge of the Gods arc, Diana's origin is tied to the larger myth of Pandora.
Right.
What is your favorite example in any medium, so it doesn't have to be comics, of tying a character's story, even if it's not their origin, to a larger story? And then do you have a least favorite example?
So, very good question. I mean, the big story arcs come to mind. So you had Barry Allen, who for the longest time based his, you know, his identity of the Flash on a comic book
character. Jay Garrick, yeah.
And then suddenly there was enough, you know, reader calls to bring Jay Garrick back. So they invented an entirely separate dimension.
Yeah.
And creating the multiverse from that one. So his simple origin story of, oh, I just read a comic book. He created a whole separate mythology with
That's
Earth
a good
2.
Answer.
You could also kind of, you know, combine that with creating the Speed Force. At first it was just lightning bolt, you know, the typical like random accident stuff. And all of a sudden Wally West, you know, enters the Speed Force, and it was preordained. He, he was the lightning bolt that created him. And now you have not just a Speed Force, but you have the Strength Force. It's become like the spectrum of Green Lanterns. You have the, what was it, the Will Force? Not the Will Force, but there's
the
all
Still
these,
Force.
The Still Force. Yeah. I mean, all these different forces, which is an interesting idea. I mean, it was successful enough for Green Lantern. But there's also the classic Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Taking him from going Alec Holland becoming Swamp Thing to Swamp Thing being an elemental and absorbing Alec Holland's memories. And not just that, he's an avatar of the green.
Yeah.
It's this whole parliament, you know, trees, and then there's like the avatar of the red.
The rot.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great idea. Now, my least favorite, and you know I've probably said this a billion times, my least favorite is James Robinson's, the Hunt for Starman, where he combines Will Payton's Starman with Prince Gavin's. I like the fact that he brought it back. I like the fact that James Robinson brought back all the previous Starmen in different iterations. But basically shutting down that it was Will Payton, you know, novice superhero, everyman, and just being like kind of like an imprint of Gavin on there.
Yeah, conduit.
Kind of lost it. And then a little bit later, like more recently, when they brought back Starman for Dark Knight's Metal with Perpetua. And now he was part of the totality, and he was so all these origins of his, like that energy bolt, you know, hitting him and transforming him. I like the one that was originally set. It was, oddly enough, part of another crossover invasion.
Yeah.
Where it was like the
Dominators.
Redirecting the stellar converter and shooting him just to see what a metahuman, you know, could be like and stuff.
It's funny that you bring that up, because the James Robinson Starman run is, I think, the best book of the 90s and
a terrific
top five comic book of all time. But you're right. One place where he misses, and this is just taste, because I love Will Payton so much. I mean, he was in Phoenix, right?
Like
he was our own hero. The one I really wish he had brought Will Payton back as his own character. And he had a chance because Jack is dating Sadie, his sister. And you're right. I did not like it. There is an elegance to the Gavin Will Payton of it all, where if you're not invested in those characters, you're like, oh, that's a really smart thing to do. But it doesn't account for the emotional connection to Will Payton, whose series ran for like 4 years. So, I mean, there's a real investment. So, no, those are great answers. I especially love the Barry Allen one. You did a really good job paralleling your answers of basically like energy blasts being destiny. Cause the lightning that strikes Barry Allen and then Wally West, there's a Secret Origins annual 2 from 1988. It's Bill Messner Loebs and Robert Loren Fleming. And they basically tell that secret Barry Allen in running to defeat the Anti-Monitor's machine becomes the very lightning that strikes his chemicals. And then Wally's going to have something similar in his future, but he's the lightning as well. That the beauty of that, that's maybe my favorite retcon of all time. I know some people hate it, but it's funny because I hate it on Starman. I hate, you know, like you really have the same thing, energy blast, given destiny, but I didn't like it there. So that's really funny. I went with a couple. This one's probably going to be a little controversial. My favorite example of tying a character's origin into a larger story is Captain America being Weapon part of the Weapon Plus program.
That's so...
Yeah, yes. He's Weapon One, yes. Basically. That the United States didn't realize it, but in creating Captain America, they started the Weapon Plus program. He's Weapon One, and, you know, Wolverine is Weapon 10, Weapon X.
It's kind of what they were trying to fold into the MCU.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that Captain America was... I mean, because you see that throwback to the Hulk when Captain America first gets the injection. He has the green eyes... Shout out.
I love it because I think it's really smart storytelling because, of course, the government wouldn't have stopped there, right. You know? My least favorite example is from a different medium. It's from Star Wars, the movies. And I hate the Rey Skywalker tie to Palpatine.
Oh, yes.
The entire purpose of the first couple movies is she's nobody special.
Yeah.
She's not a Skywalker. She's not a Palpatine. She's not a Solo. Anybody can be the hero of this story. Like, it's any poor kid on a desert planet can find a lightsaber and save the universe. And to force it to have her be weirdly, and even they don't even do a good job doing it, related to like a clone of Palpatine. Just, I don't know.
That was, undermines it. They basically took everything from The Last Jedi, the main movie, and just said, yeah, let's just throw it away. Let's start from scratch again. And none of the anyone can now be a Force user and Rey is just a nobody kind of thing. Those were all great. And it just didn't tie in very well.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It undermines, I think, what made her really special.
She was special.
And then and then even the fact that Finn clearly is a Force user or becoming one. And
is he going to be like the distant son of Lando or something?
Exactly. Like, how are you going to tie this all together? Yeah. And I really liked the... It can be anyone.
Yeah.
You know, it's Into the Spider-Verse, right? Anyone can be Spider-Man.
Exactly.
And I think they missed their... Yes.
They missed their cowboy, a detective.
Yeah. Anybody did.
They missed an anime three. Remote. Yeah, sure.
So that brings us to the end of the issue. But let's talk about the art for a moment. Do you have a favorite panel?
Yes. It's actually two. My favorite... is on page 18.
Yeah.
It's the big multi-layered panel. It's definitely something out of, his issues with Crisis.
Oh, it's right out of Crisis.
Just from the crazy machine that's holding back, is it Tartarus or is it? Yeah, it's Tartarus, right?
Yeah, I call it Hellmouth because of Hellmouth, Buffy.
Yeah. Doom's Doorway.
Yeah. Yeah.
From Diana throwing her head back in a cry, all the Paradise Island Amazons quaking, looking up, even like he's kind of discarded after this, but you even see Hercules now unshackled and in human form. You can see him grabbing for Hippolyta's arm, to clutch her. And you see, they even mentioned that earthquake, like the seismologists all around the world were detecting, the earthquakes. And then finally, the last absorption of Diana with the demon plague. And that's just a really great one. The other one I really like is on page 4, but it's just very humorous, and it's very endemic of Perez's depiction of Mount Olympus, where it's all M.C. Escher.
Yeah,
it's basically Hermes looking like he's sitting on one in one direction and just poking his head out sideways, and then Zeus crackling, and he's got his hands above his head, and he's kind of in a running pose, and it's almost like he's saying, I've got Tegrin. This side's tingling. This side is not, and they're just kind of kooky. I mean, this whole issue, these last 12 issues, have all been very, Shakespearean, Stentorian.
Yeah.
I'm calling out to the last row of the theater, and they're all like making these pontifications and statements. If Penn is long dead, then who?
Yeah.
Dude, that's your son,
Great job, Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. A 1,000 years and you never noticed?
I know.
You never checked in?
Yeah. And all Zeus's response is, an excellent question.
Yeah.
And one will soon be answered.
I do love, Perez playing with Olympus, with physics on Olympus, that the gods are just not even subject to physics.
I looked through, like, especially like the last issue during Crisis, and I never saw any depiction of Olympus like this before.
No.
Which is terrific. I was wondering, because they eventually brought back a lot of stuff, like on Themyscira, they brought back the kangaroos,
Kangas.
And I was just curious if this had ever been done before. And no, and I think it's just genius.
Perez's ability as a storyteller is unparalleled. He never tells you, he and we never say, the gods are so powerful that our laws of physics don't apply to them, but he tells you every time he depicts them in Olympus. It is phenomenal. And also, there's a chaos to it. they're never pointing the same way.
Yes.
They're never moving the same direction. There's always somebody has an angle. Somebody has. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's so brilliant. I went with page 18 as well. And in particular, mm-hmm. that panel of Diana getting blasted, mimicking Crisis 12, mimicking Crisis 7, mimicking Wonder Woman 6. But this time,
yes.
holding the line and holding against the demon plague. So, I mean, really, this is Perez is on layouts and Patterson on finishes. This was more Perez than Patterson mm-hmm. in some of these pages because they are screaming Perez's work. So really, really amazing job. Before we wrap up and get to the last segment of the book, I do have a remaining secret question.
Okay.
There wasn't a great place to fit it in, but I like it and I want to ask it. So Diana learns that as part of the purpose of her creation from clay, it's to rectify the sin of the last woman the gods created from clay, Pandora. Ignoring the misogynist overtones of the Pandora myth for a bit, I know that's asking a lot. Who is your favorite, quote-unquote, bad girl in any medium?
So I'm gonna... Okay, so she's not the best villain.
Uh-huh.
And she's not the best even villain for the specific team that she's been the villain for. But she's just really good, and it's the Emerald Empress.
Oh.
She's so...
Great choice.
With the Emerald Eye...
The Legion, yeah.
Yeah, with the Legion of Superheroes. With the Emerald Eye, she's pretty much nigh unbeatable unless she just kind of loses her willpower to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm basically referring to the first one, which was Sayra or something like that. She from Nergal or whatever or something. Mm-hmm. She's the one that I was first introduced for. And she's never... I mean, her you can never break her, basically, yeah. Unless she just decides to give up herself. She is the backbone, I think, of the Fatal Five.
Yeah,
and just in her own solo appearances, she's been terrifying.
Yeah,
I always thought when it was either her or Mordru, when they showed up, I'm like, okay, I've got to get my seatbelt on. I'm gonna get ready. Who else?
Great choice. I like that haughty villain too. The like. Empress,
yes.
The, like, I'm better than you, I'm more powerful than you, and yeah, she was the power behind the Fatal Five.
I think a second runner-up would Saffron, or Yosaf Bridge, from Firefly.
Oh.
But she's really well-written. This is the height of Joss Whedon, when he was writing just really good characters. And she's just... you never know who she actually is. Is she Yolanda? Yeah. Is she Saffron? Is she, you know, Bridget? I mean, they just, of the small amount, I think it's like 13 or 14 episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all totally great episodes. But anytime she appears is awesome.
Christina
Hendricks.
Yeah, it was going to drive me crazy,
I mean,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. That's a great answer. I love Saffron. That is a really, really, really good answer. I have a type. I definitely love the bad girl thief that sort of captures the heart of a hero. So I love Catwoman. I love Black Cat. Dr. Aphra, more recent creation. So when Marvel got the Star Wars license again back in 2015-16, Kieran Gillen created, he wrote the Darth Vader book, mm-hmm. and he created this character, Dr. Aphra, who's like an archaeologist. Her parents are like famous archaeologists,
yeah.
and she's broke bad. And she's awesome because she's super charming, brilliant and conniving, but she ain't good.
Right,
like you're not, you know, every once in a while you'll be like, oh, I'm going to root for Dr. Aphra. And then you're like, oh, she flat out had her dark Wookiee kill that guy. So I definitely have a type. And so for this question, I'm going to go with Vash. I also saying
from Star Trek.
Yeah. From Star Trek, the next generation. Vash is like Dr. Aphra, is a human archaeologist and profiteer, but captures the heart of Jean-Luc Picard. And in particular, my first encounter with Vash, which I think is her first appearance, is when he has to go on vacation.
Yeah, yeah. Captain's Holiday.
So he is, you know, Jean-Luc Picard, he's stentorian and mm-hmm. buttoned up and, you know, inflexible, indomitable will. Mm-hmm. You know, we know he's a noble man who has emotions, but he doesn't show them to the crew. And so we know Picard as this, like, archetypal leader. And he gets forced on this vacation, and he's in like shorts and like a Tommy Bahama shirt and like a cocktail. And so first of all, just to see him in that mm-hmm. way is amazing. But then he meets Vash and they go on this adventure together, and you see that like at heart, he's a boy who wants adventures.
Yes.
You know, he wants to swing on vines yep. and he wants to be Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. And it gives you such a cool look into Picard, but it doesn't shortchange her. She is an awesome and complex character who is not going to do what he needs her to do for them to be together, he's going to have to come to her.
Oh, and she lets him do most of the work, too.
Oh, yeah. She's brilliant. She outsmarts him at every turn. But she also, twinkle in her eye, you know, has a real affection for him. And so I love that character.
Oh, yeah. She's great. I mean, even in the episode where she's literally kidnapped by Q and forced into Robin Hood, she's never a person that needs rescuing.
No.
She's a great character. She would have probably been a really good character on a different show. I mean, she made an appearance on Deep Space Nine, and that story kind of muddled itself through. They didn't know really what they were kind of shooting for. At one point, the other character involved in that was supposed to be Guinan's son, but then they cast a white actor. But I mean, it still could work. Oddly enough, the actor who played that was the guy from Fright Night. The Vampire
Nice.
Yeah, she's a great character. I mean, she would make an excellent Star Trek character in another series.
Yeah, she could be, you could whole cloth lift her. She could have gotten her own series. Yeah.
Exactly.
I love her. I love that archetype. I love the, like, you know, and I especially love when it's a woman.
Yeah.
You know, because historically you do see Gambit or those kinds of male characters, but it's so much fun.
Yeah, the super competent character that makes often the male character realize, oh, I'm not actually the superhero as she is.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love her. So, Alex, that's going to bring us to the end of the episode in our last segment, unless you've got a secret question.
I have one secret question.
You got burning a hole in your pocket. All right.
Exactly. So, my question is, a really big part of this 13 issues has been Hippolyta's and Diana's relationship. It's pretty much unique in comics.
Yeah.
You have seen other mother-daughter relationships of Sue Storm and Valeria.
Yeah.
You've seen it with Black Canary 1 and 2. Even Liberty Bell and Jesse Quick.
Oh, yeah.
It's been kind of tentative. A lot of times it's been either it's been very contentious. Valeria sees Doom as almost a more of a parent.
And I always see Valeria more as Reed's kid than
True. Eden's. Yeah, because they're the smart. Yeah. Whereas Franklin has more of the imagination of Sue. And Black Canary, most of the time it's Black Canary 1 is saying, I don't want you to be a crime fighter or dying on her deathbed. And then Jesse Quick and Liberty Bell kind of the same way.
Well, I mean, in the Justice Society series from the early 90s by Mike Parabek, they sleep with the same guy.
Yes, that's right.
Not great.
But a lot of times it's like father-son or even father-daughter.
Yeah.
But I know in kind of doing a little research for this part of the series, I've seen some people call Hippolyta a toxic mom.
Oh.
They use examples where she's instilled insecurity in Diana.
Yeah.
She didn't support Diana's own choices. Basically made her, you know, kind of recheck what she really wants to do. And others have said she's an amazing mom. She's an amazing queen, an amazing leader, and she balances it all. She does what she does that causes the conflict is because all she wants to do is protect her daughter.
Yeah.
Her daughter, as I said before, has this destiny, and this destiny is littered with pain, and she wants to make it as easy as possible. Now, do you think that Hippolyta's relationship with Diana leans more on the toxic side, or is it normal for the mythological scenario that we have?
That's a really good question. Really good question. And it's actually a difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Because of the serialized nature of comic books. So if we're being fair, and I'm saying Wonder Woman Volume 2, issues 1 through 13, then she is an amazing mom. Her concerns express themselves, as would anybody. She doesn't want her daughter to go to man's world, but she doesn't stop her. She trusts her daughter and she trusts the gods enough. She worries, but she trusts. She loves Diana enough that when Diana goes into the Hellmouth, even before that, when Zeus is, you know, aggressively making moves on Diana, Hippolyta offers herself up in her stead. And then when Diana has to go to Hellmouth, Hippolyta leaves her kingdom, basically takes her crown off, goes into the Hellmouth to help her daughter. So no, she is a phenomenal mother who trusts Diana when Diana binds her to Heracles. Mm-hmm. So it's a very loving relationship that is growing as Hippolyta sees more and more of Diana's capabilities. It's got an asterisk next to it.
Yes.
Because in volume one of Wonder Woman, Hippolyta's always brainwashing Diana, like, Steve Trevor's dead. No, he's alive. Oh, this is Steve Trevor, but actually it's Eros. And then in later years, you know, William Messner Loeb's and Mike Diodato's run, Hippolyta's going to learn that prophecy that Wonder Woman's going to die.
Yes.
So she reholds the contest, rigs it so Artemis wins.
Yes.
Artemis dies, and Diana's like, I cannot forgive you for this. Like, you literally, effectively murdered somebody in my stead. So there are times where she's toxic, but if we're going to be fair and only count what we've covered on the show, then no, she's amazing. What about
you? I'm kind of in agreement with you. Yeah, the George Perez run, she's terrific. She's everything you want in a queen, in a mother, and everything. Yeah, it's that overarching story from, you know, the 40s to now. I mean, you had her meddling, you know, from in the comic books, in the TV series. She was more of like the nosy neighbor kind of thing. And then, all the way to when they wanted to switch things up and they used, you know, Hippolyta as the foil to change to Artemis. And then crazy things like when they were ramping up to in the early 2000s with like Amazon's attack, which I thought was a great idea on paper, but it just sort of tanked. And she kind of went nuts with the whole, like, you know, you killed my daughter. No, I'm still alive. You know, okay, well, we're still going to attack, you know, the United States anyway.
Yeah, definitely Hippolyta's not, you know, writers will use her as a foil in some ways. And, you know, I never really enjoy that. I liked my favorite Hippolyta moments are this run. Definitely when she's Polly back at JSA. And then when she sacrifices herself in Our Worlds at War, basically to like stop that ship from descending onto the Earth and dies basically in her daughter's place. And so I think she's an amazing character. You know, again, over the course of, she was created in 1940. So over the course of, you know, 85 years, there's going to be some less great stories with her. But
and without friction, honestly, I mean, is there even a story? I mean, I'm constantly yelling at Rory and Lorelai for, you know, having fights and stuff on the Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
But honestly, without those fights, it's just like, hey, how you doing? Great day at school. Yeah. Thanks, Mom. Bye. You know.
And she's not Lucille Bluth or, you know.
No, like,
you know,
gosh, yes. Yeah, that would be a great Wonder Woman series. In fact, I think she actually did voice Hippolyta at least
did
on
she
one
seriously?
Cartoon.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
I mean, Cloris Leachman was Hippolyta. Yeah,
that's so funny. So, listeners, that brings us to the end of discussing the issue, but not the end of the episode, because every episode of Peace Banded Down ends with a segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, where the guest and I join in on Diana's sacred mission and talk about a serious or silly way we would bring peace to the world. So, since Alex, you're the guest, I want you to have the last word. I'm going to go first. And so, this one's silly, but also kind of serious. So I was on the internet, like you do, and I saw something that said that the first time most men are given flowers is at their funeral. Oh, and that is wild. Like, it is horribly sad.
Yeah, I mean,
that
you don't even get to enjoy it.
I mean, but it's such an incredibly sad statement on masculinity and the way men are viewed. And like, I it really did hit me when I heard that. I was like, my God. And so I don't know if it's factual, but it sounds right, and it, you know, sounds sadly real. So to bring a little bit of peace to man's world, I would encourage people to send flowers to the men in their lives. Now, the spin I would put on it to combat some of the little toxic masculinity that runs through our country, or the lot of toxic masculinity, is I would have flowers companies and florists use the same marketing techniques that other companies use on men and name the bouquets something manly. So, like, for example, bouquets could be called things like Rose Rush or Carnation Blast or Tulip Tornado. And let's get these men some flowers so that they know they're loved, but like in a manly way before they die.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah, let's give men some flowers. What about you?
Well, so mine's not as innovative or grandiose. I mean, for more of like a personal piece, just make an effort. Try to etch out some extra time to have some more personal one-on-one time with a family member or a friend or whatever. In the same vein that you were with the flowers, I mean, work out some time. And if you're going to give someone a birthday card, make it yourself. Even if it's like the worst stick figure, just make it personal. I think it really does go a long way.
Yeah.
For world peace, you know, it's not a great movie, but I love its ending, is Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. One song unites the whole planet.
Yeah.
I would love something magical like that to happen on this planet, where one event, everyone just sort of suddenly realizes, hey, we're all together on this planet. You know, and it just creates like harmony worldwide. And then we could travel to Mars and have the concert there like they did in the movie. But I mean, you know, just remember that everyone is human. You may be having a bad day. Try not to inflict it on other people. And if you need help, you know, try to reach out to someone and talk to them.
Yeah, I think about a couple things when you say that, and I fully agree. I think about All-Star Superman, where Lex Luthor gets Superman's senses. He gets his powers. And he's like, oh my God, is this how you see the world? Like, this is unbelievable. And he starts crying.
Yeah.
And Clark's like, now you get it. And then this is a weird tangent, but did you ever read Rising Stars?
Yeah.
So J. Michael Straczynski, mm-hmm. it's an Image book. Starts off really hot. I don't remember who the artist is, unfortunately, but very Image style art for that time. And I mean, there were so many delays. I think at one point there were like 5 and 6 year delays because he went to work for Marvel and things like that. But eventually he circles back and finishes that book. And the end of the book, I don't know if you remember it, it's basically the event.
Yeah, happens.
That mm-hmm. Yeah, that the reason people were getting superpowers was predicting this like event. And they are worried that it's the end of the world. But in fact, it's almost this like unimind thing where mm-hmm. everybody suddenly inhabits everybody's mind and soul for a moment. And then it flashes back to their own individuality. But you can't live in somebody else's soul and mind and not be touched and the world not be a better place. And so it's like the first step to the evolution of a wonderful world. So it's so funny because that is in some ways, that's a series for me that epitomizes a series that peters out on its initial promise.
Yes.
But the ending is really lovely. So yeah, nice. Very nice. So thank you so much for joining me. I am so thankful. Folks listening don't know, but it was literally an odyssey for us to get together today. Yes. Ironically, or maybe not ironically, but interestingly, there is a women's marathon today.
Every woman's marathon in Scottsdale.
Yeah, and where Alex lives. And so I was driving from Phoenix to Scottsdale to record in person, and I got just knee deep in this marathon. And I'm texting him like, hey, I'm going to be late. There's just thousands of women running around me right now. And he's like, oh, yeah, the marathon. And so, you know, it was both, you know, frustrating to be stuck in traffic, but also uplifting that it was this marathon for a whole city. And, but I'm so glad we were able to get together. I'm so glad we were able to record. Thank you so much for joining me today. And listeners, we'll take a podcast promo break, and then I will be back with your feedback from issue 12 of volume 2.
Hi, I'm Eric, host of the Long Box Review podcast. I love comic books so much that I started Long Box Review to celebrate my love for them and connect with others who share my passion. Each month, I critique the comics I've read and present other topics such as spotlights on specific issues, my comics history, the Legion Project with Peter Rios, where we discuss the Legion of Superheroes, and so much more. Additionally, the Long Box Review podcast feed includes The Gutters, my audio journal, and Center Seat, my Star Trek podcast. The Long Box Review website also examines comic books outside of the podcast, such as the series 52, Justice, and others. Please join me as I celebrate nearly 50 years of comic book reading and over 15 years of podcasting. You can visit longboxreview.com for more information. And thanks for listening.
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback for Wonder Woman issue 12, which I covered with Eric Isaacson from the Long Box Review. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. Now, up first, we have a first-time writer-inner, which is a term I just made up, named Sean Hansen, and he spells Sean the right way, S-E-A-N, so well done. He says, I'm from Massachusetts, and I've genuinely never heard of the Suzy Qs. This doesn't necessarily mean we don't have them here. I just never look for those types of snacks while at the supermarket. But my mom always made the most delicious pumpkin whoopie pies in the fall. I'm still one of those things I associate most with that time of year. Keep up the great work. I'm now a huge Wonder Woman fan because of this phenomenal podcast. Well, Sean, thank you so much for listening and writing in. It's so funny that on the last episode, we talked about whoopie pies, which are a very regional thing in the northeast part of the country, Massachusetts, Maine, and everywhere else. People just know them as Suzy Q's because that's the Hostess product. And I love that this has captured the imagination of some of the listeners. I love a good Suzy Q and a good whoopie pie. So, you know, but more importantly, thanks for the kind words. It means a lot that you're listening along and reading the series and loving it. Up next is Martin Gray, who says, cheers, Sean and Eric, for a typically enjoyable listen. Wonder Woman number 12 is a great issue, very well plotted and executed. Martin refers to Eric's Lasso of Truth moment where he talks about being a superhero by saying,
I love the idea of Eric patrolling the streets as a kid. Surely it's time for a comeback. I would pay to see that. That'd be pretty awesome. Martin goes on to say, I'd never heard of Sedona, Arizona until this week. It's the setting for Robin and Supergirl's adventure in the New World's Finest. So we had mentioned Sedona in the episode. It's actually where I got married. And it's this beautiful part of North Central Arizona. It has these red rocks, this red clay. It's just gorgeous. It's considered to be very spiritual. And it cracks me up because Martin's comment came in and I had not read that new issue of World's Finest yet. And then I went on to read it and I was like, hey, Sedona, that's where I got married. Martin weighs in on the Susie Q discussion saying, ah, Susie Q is a type of confectionery. I've only heard of Susie Q in relation to Ben Grimm occasionally calling Sue Storm that back when Marvel was good. I've had a look online to see what the suite is all about and honestly can't see what's enticing about the thing. It only looks like the most disgusting artificial confection ever, like a something brown, organic, and stinky sliced through with fake cream. Is there anything in there that doesn't come out of a lab? No, Martin, there isn't. And that's actually, for many of us, the joy of it. It is the capital A artificial confection. It is super yummy and super chemically engineered. And yeah, I'm not proud of myself for loving it, but I do. Martin wraps up by addressing Eric's awesome secret question about who is your favorite patriotic superhero? What's your favorite star-spangled costume? And Martin says, as regards starry, starry costumes, Citizen V is a great choice. Thanks, Martin. That was mine. Martin says, I agree the second Star-Spangled Kid / Star Girl had a great look, even if I do always see Yankee Poodle from Captain Carrot. There's a lot of Yankee Poodle talk in the messages for this month because of that patriotic question. And, you know, good for Yankee Poodle getting her due. Up next is Tim Price, who writes in to say, the meeting of Diana and Diana Trevor is the moment of this series. I could barely keep myself from reading ahead because this payoff for this plot point laid down in issue one is one of the most satisfying ever. I know it's not perfect, but I simply adore it and how it motivates Wonder Woman going forward in a subtle fashion. And back in the day, a year was a long time to get to this payoff. With today's storytelling, this wouldn't have happened until issue 49 as the lead up to an issue 50 blowout. Thanks for writing in, Tim. I also love the Diana Trevor reveal. I love that moment where they get to meet. It's such a great way post-crisis to connect Steve and Diana in a way that, in my mind, is just as meaningful as their connection in pre-crisis continuity, though I can't really speak. I didn't collect pre-crisis Wonder Woman as dedicatedly as most or some, and so they may disagree, but I really love it. I love connecting them as almost as family in a way. It's going to cement Steve's presence in the book as a mentor figure and as somebody that Diana really cares for, though not romantically. And yeah, I thought it was a great issue as well. Up next is my buddy Clinton Robinson, who is the first of many, and there's going to be a little run in the comments here to talk about the secret question related to favorite moment with dad and favorite moment with mom. Clinton says, oh man, these father stories hit hard. Thank you both for sharing these. Well, thanks, Clinton. I really appreciated Eric going along with this. I knew I was asking a couple of unusual secret questions that, you know, could stir up some emotional responses. And Eric was such an awesome, awesome person and guest and such a good sport to go along. David Ace Gutierrez writes in to talk about dads and moms as well. And he says, how does this show keep getting better and better? Thanks, David. He says, as for best dad memory, my dad gave me a pony ride to breakfast every day when I was a kid. That is so cute. One day he just asked which Star Wars figure I'd like. I told him and he did his best to get them. He really tried to make me happy, even as a kid, and has remained my hero my whole life. You talked about seeing the end. My dad has congestive heart failure that he's working to control through diet and exercise, but I know we're getting close to the end, and every day I have with him is truly a gift. Dag, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm so sorry about your father's health, but what a beautiful way to see the impact he's had on your life and to treasure every day that you have with him. David goes on to say, best mom memory. Well, there are so many from which to choose. He says, I'm a big mama's boy, as we all are. I think it has to be the first time she held my son. I've never seen her happier, and that's something I will carry with me always. It's getting dusty in here, Dag. Your comment made me tear up. I have a daughter, and the first time I saw my mom hold my daughter, you know, the first time I saw my sisters, my nephews, every first time somebody held my kid, it just, you know, warmed my heart. So that's a really beautiful memory. And thank you for writing in. Network's own Paul Keehan, host of DC Special Cast, also commented on this secret question saying, my dad drives me crazy now, but I have great memories growing up. He encouraged all reading and made sure I had all kinds of stuff to read and never looked down on comics, which many parents did in the 70s. He would go into work on Saturday morning, and I would go with him. We would stop at the corner store before the office, and I would get a bunch of comics to read while he was working. Very fond memories of that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Paul. As somebody who cares for his elderly mother, I get the, you know, drives you crazy now moment, you know, though we love them. I love that your dad would buy you Shut Up and Read comics when he went to work and needed you otherwise occupied. I think we could add an entire show. Maybe this is you and me down the road on the network. We could add an entire show called Shut Up and Read, where people just join us and talk about stories about their parents buying them Shut Up comics. And, you know, those are, I'm sure for many of us, some of our favorite books ever. Fellow Network All-Star, host of Fantastic Poor, Brett Young writes in to say, "Great show, guys. This may have been my favorite issue of the series to date, as well as my favorite Peace Bound and Down episode." Ah, thanks. Thanks, Brett. "So well done. I always love this cover by Perez with the sense of desperation mixed in with impending doom. His dark inks sold the feel of this cover so well. Just incredible." Brett goes on to comment on the dad-mom stories. He says, "For a dad story, when I was in middle school, I biked over to my dad's house. My folks were divorced, but my dad lived a couple of miles away. I came into the house and walked up to the loft where he was watching a hockey game. Soon as he saw me, he turned off the TV and asked me how I was doing. For some reason, it always stuck in my head that instead of turning the volume down or talking over the sound of the game, he immediately turned it off to hear what I had to say. Even though I know he loved the Flyers, it was a simple thing, but it signified that what I had to say was more important, and that I mattered to him. I mean, I always knew that, but sometimes small gestures like that stick with you for whatever reason. I lost my dad earlier this year. Sorry to hear that, Brett. The last time I saw him before he passed, I told him about the time and how I've always tried to implement that now that I'm a father. To always make sure that my kids know that they're being heard and that they matter." I mean, that's just so beautiful, Brett. Thank you so much for sharing that story. As a dad, I took that to heart as well. And, you know, I'm not always great about turning the volume down on the Suns game to talk to my kiddo. And it struck home. So really, really beautiful memory. Brett goes on to tell the story about his mom, saying, "I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, so it was not uncommon to get mice in the house." Oh, we get scorpions here. That's gross enough. I couldn't handle mice. "One of my mother's greatest traits is her empathy. To this day, I remember her insisting that instead of getting mouse traps, we just try to get them to leave. Surprisingly, these negotiations didn't work, and other means of persuasion had to be used." That is so funny, and it's super sweet. It is telling of how caring a person your mom is, but I love the idea of mice-human negotiation. Brett wraps up saying, "Favorite Star Spangled costume? Apollo Creed at the beginning of Rocky IV, of course, although it didn't end that well for Apollo." That is the best comment. Carl Weathers just rocks those trunks in that robe, even though, you know, Ivan Drago ends that run. Super Captain goes on to say, "My dad passed away a little over 8 years ago. I'm sorry to hear that, but I have so many great memories. He never graduated high school, but I don't know that I've ever met anyone with more, quote, interpersonal intelligence. As we say back home, he never met a stranger. He aided and abetted my comic reading when I was growing up. And even though he always referred to them as funny books, if the latest bundle of comics hadn't been put on the spinner rack at the newsstand, Dad would often ask an employee if they would cut them open for me just so I could have first crack at the latest Who's Who, All-Star Squadron, and New Mutants." Super Captain, that, again, getting dusty in here. That story hit close to home. My stepdad, my mom remarried at one point. My stepdad was a really good man, and he was old school guy, had served in Korea in the Korean War. I mean, that he was a much older man and did not understand my love of comics, but never judged me for it and, you know, never said anything negative. And I have a very distinct memory of him driving me to the comic book store one night, and the guy was closing up like 10 minutes early, and my stepdad just negotiating with him to open the door, let me run in, grab whatever 5 comics I could grab, pay for them, and go. And it's such a fond memory. It's a small moment. My stepdad has passed away, and I'm sure it's not a moment he would have remembered when he was here, but it's a moment that lives with me forever. Super Captain goes on to say, "Dad worked with the police department and emergency services in our little town, so we often worked on Sundays. So Mom and I would be on our way home from church, and we'd stop by the same newsstand. Mom would send me in with money to get the Sunday paper and one comic. Most of the time, I came back without change and 2 or 3 comics." That's like all of us, man. We're all grifters for comics. "She could never get too upset with me for buying comics or any other book for that matter." That's great. Again, thank you for sharing that. Super Captain goes on to finish addressing that Star Spangled question, saying, "As far as best Star Spangled costumes and characters, Cap is my favorite Marvel hero, and it's hard to beat Courtney Whitmore, aka Stargirl. Martin Gray also mentioned Yankee Poodle, whom I also like." Again, man, Yankee Poodle getting more play in this comment section than she has in comics in 40 years. Up next is Dr. Ange, who also addressed some secret questions, though different ones than those before. Dr. Ange addresses the Star-Spangled costume question, saying, I think I have to go old school with Captain America because I loved how the red and white stripes are incorporated into the blue scale mail armor with a single star. Perfect. Yeah, the Steve Rogers Captain America costume is unassailable, Dr. Ange. Great choice. Dr. Ange addresses the another question we had about favorite journey into hell for a hero, which is, you know, a part of the monomyth cycle of Joseph Campbell, and every hero goes through it. And he says, I have to say that Alan Moore Swamp Thing annual, where Swampy descends into hell to save Abby Arcane's soul. It's almost a sort of divine comedy as Swampy is ushered through the realms by Phantom Stranger, the Spectre, and the Demon. There's a moment when Swamp Thing runs into Anton Arcane's soul being tortured, and Arcane asks, how many centuries have I been down here? And Swamp Thing says, you died yesterday. It just puts the concept of eternal damnation into a very concrete sense of time. Hard agree, Dr. Ange. That is maybe one of my favorite single issues of all time. It is so brilliantly written. And as somebody who loves Dante's Inferno, taught it for years, I really love any comic book that homages it really effectively. Ange finishes up by saying, worst crossover ever. We had asked about favorite crossovers and worst crossovers. This is going to come as no surprise to anybody who knows Dr. Ange. He says, 25 years later, I am still pissed about Hawk and Dove being the Armageddon 2001 patch. I love that you call him a patch. As Shag might say, that is the albatross around Hawk and Dove's neck. They have never recovered. So sad. Heck, in the Hawk and Dove Armageddon annual, Wave Rider says neither of these heroes could ever be Monarch. Idiotic. Yeah, again, you and I are on this island. We both own land on Hawk and Dove Island, Dr. Ange. We might be the last two. It ruined those characters. It was a horrible, you know, last second move by DC because they got spooked that people figured out it was Captain Atom. I don't love that it was Captain Atom because I loved that character too, but it makes way more sense than Hawk and destroyed Don Granger as Dove, which is the greater sin. Bucky749, as usual, brings up the rear with a secret question. And he says, okay, here's the secret question. A lot of movies are getting released to the big screens. Let's say Wonder Woman ends up going to movies with her crew. Which classic movie do you think they would see? The original Clash of the Titans, Back to the Future Part 3, or Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan? As always, Bucky, I love your secret questions. Your specificity in movies kills me. The Clash of the Titans made total sense, and then we get randomly Back to the Future Part 3. But okay, of those three, I think Clash of the Titans makes the most sense because it's going to be the most familiar. Though of those three, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is by far the best movie and is, you know, the best movie in that series. Perhaps the best Star Wars movie ever. I'm going to say that unassailably the best Star Trek movie ever. Well, thank you for writing in with a secret question, Bucky. I always appreciate them. Thank you to everybody who listened to this episode. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. The engagement in the comments is my favorite part of hosting the show, in particular this month with a couple of emotional questions and just getting to know a lot of you better and getting to hear some beautiful stories about the beautiful people who helped raise you. Thank you again to Eric Isaacson for being my co-host on that episode. Thank you to Alex Orman for being my co-host on this episode, and thank you for joining me next month as we try to bring a little bit of peace to man's world.